Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com. Marley was dead to begin with. There is no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it. And Scrooge's name was good upon change for anything he chose to put his hand to. Old Marley was as dead as a doornail.
Well, happy Christmas, everybody. That was Dominic, of course, reading the opening to A Christmas Carol. And Dominic, here we are, just before Christmas.
Professional quality.
And what could be more festive than to actually be out and about in the streets of this great capital of ours?
So I stand here and I see a sign that says, "Motorcyclists, please do not start your engines." We're standing in what, to untutored eyes, Tom, would seem like a sort of just a deserted yard. But you're going to explain why you've dragged me from
all the way from the Cotswolds, your hobbit hole in the Cotswolds, all the way down into the very heart of London. And I have to say that you are looking absolutely full of festive fare.
Right. My face like thunder as I walked into the coffee shop before the recording started.
As you were walking here, ragamuffins were knocking your top hat off with snowballs. They could tell the Scrooge-like expression on your face.
Full of Christmas cheer. There's nothing I like more than being summoned down to London by Tom Holland with a pandemic raging.
Exactly. Well, we're in a place called Newman Court, which is just off Cornhill. And Cornhill is one of the main roads in the City of London. It leads from the Bank of England up towards Leadenhall Market. But the reason that we're here is that, insofar as we can tell, Newman Court is the likeliest place for Scrooge's counting house.
So, Scrooge, obviously, the central character in A Christmas Carol, the kind of definitive canonical Christmas text, I think.
Probably the most adapted Christmas.
Definitely.
Well, I mean, probably the most adapted story in English, maybe in the world.
Apart from the Nativity itself.
Yeah, apart from that. Yes, another work of fiction.
So published in December 1843 by Charles Dickens.
The same year, apparently, as Christmas cards were first sent.
Is that right?
So, yeah, it's a great year for the Victorian Christmas.
A very big year. Well, of course, Christmas has sort of been in the ether a little bit for the Victorians for a few years before A Christmas Carol comes out. You know, the amazing thing, actually, Tom, you know how old Dickens, obviously you do know how old he was when he...
Remind me.
31.
Yeah.
31, and he'd already written 6 books.
Well, I think the thing about Dickens, so when he's writing this, as you say, he's a young man. I mean, when you read about how he came to write Christmas Carol, what impresses you, as almost every detail of Dickens always does, is the unbelievable sense of energy.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of terrifying, almost demonic level of energy. Because as it took him six weeks to write Christmas Carol. As he wrote it, he would kind of laugh and cry and gurn and prance around the room whenever there was any particular...
But he's also doing these walks at night, isn't he? Where he's walking 15 to 20 miles
so he walks around all day, London. And then he relaxes by going for 50-mile walks across the city.
So he's sort of extraordinary. But he does it partly because he needs money. So he's had some quite big name books. So Pickwick Papers, Oliver Twist, Nicholas Nickleby. But his most recent book, Martin Chuzzlewit, has been
well.
A bit of a failure. His wife, I think, is expecting another baby.
Yep.
His publishers have basically told him
they're nagging him.
Yeah, they've told him they're going to pay him less unless he basically improves and ups his game. So obviously Christmas makes sense because he knows in this kind of domesticated Victorian world, middle class world, there are lots of people who are interested in Christmas as a kind of family holiday and are interested in kind of reviving some of the traditions that have been lost. Because that's a lot of what a Christmas carol, it's inventing and reviving Christmas traditions.
And Christmas seems to be incredibly important to Dickens. So right from the beginning, he sketches by Boz, his very first work. There's a whole, you know, one of the sketches is of Christmas. And The Mystery of Edwin Drood, which is his last unfinished novel, There's a kind of a murder that takes place actually on Christmas. So it's a theme that runs right the way through. And I guess that, you know, I mean, people always, when they talk about Dickens' psychology, they always go back to the trauma that he suffered.
The
blacking, you know, he gets sent to a blacking factory. His father goes to a debtor's prison. The sense in which beyond the, you know, the comforts of a middle class household, well, ignorance and want, who are the two children who the ghost of Christmas future shows to...
Well, the sort of coziness, Tom, I think, of Dickens and of Christmas depend upon the darkness.
Absolutely.
You know, the fire is burning in the grates and stuff, but outside the wind is howling, the snow's coming down or whatever. You need both for the sort of Christmas stories to really work.
Yeah. I think that A Christmas Carol just... I mean, why is it so successful? I think, I mean, it kind of partly does echo the kind of the rhythms of the original Christmas story. So you have three visitors rather than like you have, you know, the three kings. Scrooge goes to visit Tiny Tim, the little little child, rather like the shepherds and the three kings go to visit the baby Jesus. So it kind of brilliantly riffs on that without making it too obvious.
I think it's also a bit of a fairy tale quality too, though, Tom.
Absolute fairy tale quality. But it is also rooted in an absolute sense of how brutal life can be for the poor. So, the two episodes in Dickens's life just before he writes it that might have influenced him. One is he's gone to America in 1842, so the year before he writes it.
Yeah, Martin Chuzzlewit era.
And he goes to this penitentiary in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
And he goes into a cell and he writes to his friend, John Forster, and he says, I went into the cell and I was struck by the terrifying thought, what if the convict in this cell is visited by ghosts? You know, that's part of the punishment.
Yeah.
And that's obviously a kind of idea that's playing with him. And the other is that he goes to a ragged school that's been set up in Saffron Hill, which is kind of by Holborn Viaduct. Very, you know,
so
swanky
that's
area now. But
so that's basically a school for urchins, isn't it?
Yeah, but it was absolute slum in this time. It's where Fagin's hangs out with all the pickpockets in Oliver
Twist.
But
also, Tom, Scrooge. So Scrooge is such an interesting figure because there's a bit of Dickens in him. Dickens is very ambitious. Dickens is very concerned about money. Dickens is terrified of being lonely and abandoned. Obviously, he lost his father for a time as a boy. And some sort of Dickens biographers have said there's a bit of... The portrait of Scrooge is the two sides that Dickens sees in his own character. There's the sort of the guy who's all about work and money.
A squeezing, retching, gasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner.
Yes, exactly. And then there's the sort of open-handed, oh, go and get a turkey. Yeah. I love Christmas. And those are the two sides of Dickens' own persona that he's sort of exploring here. Anyway, let's talk about the place. So Scrooge's counting house... It's pretty much the first location I think we encounter, isn't it, in the book, as far as I remember. My memory of Christmas Carol is slightly coloured by the Muppet Christmas Carol.
which I'm sure we'll come to. How do we know where the address of the counting house where it opens, where Scrooge and his clerk, Bob Cratchit, are working on Christmas Eve? I mean, we're not given a precise address, but we're given various clues. So we are told that nearby there is the ancient tower of a church whose gruff old bell was always peeping slyly down at Scrooge out of a Gothic window in the wall. And this church, we're told, becomes invisible and struck the hours and quarters in the clouds with tremulous vibrations afterwards as if its teeth were chattering in its frozen head up there. So the key detail there is it's a Gothic window.
Okay.
There are, you know, two or three churches in the City of London with Gothic windows. Most of them obviously got incinerated.
Of course, in the Great Fire.
One of the churches is on Cornhill, St. Michael's Cornhill.
Okay.
And that's a key detail. Because you'll remember that Bob Cratchit, the clerk, he asks Scrooge, can he have Christmas Day off? And Scrooge is kind of very cross about that, but then says, yes, okay, you can. And we're told that when the clerk, Bob Cratchit, leaves Scrooge's office, he goes out with the long ends of his white comforter, so his I guess that's his that's scarf.
Like the scarf, really.
Dangling below his waist, for he boasted no greatcoat, he went down a slide on Cornhill at the end of a lane of boys 20 times in honour of its being Christmas Eve, and then ran home to Camden Town as hard as he could pelt to play at Blind Man's
Bar. That's a hell of a run.
It is. I mean,
that's quite
so
a run.
It's 2 or 3 miles. Yeah. But he's obviously full of energy from having sat shivering.
He's Kermit the Frog.
He's Kermit the Frog.
Version.
Exactly.
So you don't know at this stage, by the way, interestingly, that he's Bob Cratchit.
No.
He's not named.
Yeah, that comes later. So if you put those details together, you've got the church, you've got the fact that Bob Cratchit goes out from the office and he slides up and down Cornhill.
Yeah.
The likelihood is, you know, from the description, that it is this place here, which is a narrow, dark passageway coming off Cornhill. And as you say now, I mean, it's a very unromantic spot.
Yes, there's some good air conditioning units.
But there's a kind of proper Dickensian blackness to some of the brickwork.
There is. So just for some of our overseas listeners, we should say exactly where we are. Because we're in the heart of the City of London, which is not the London that most visitors see. So the old City of London,
well,
is
there
it?
Are some things that visitors... The St.
They might
Cathedral.
See St. Paul's, but generally people come, they see the West End.
Yeah.
They see... This is not that. This is the financial district now.
And it's the heart... I mean, it's the oldest centre of London. So we're actually standing on what was the Forum in the Roman city.
That's a good fact. I didn't know that.
And Cornhill, obviously, it's a hill on which they sell corn.
They sell corn, right.
And it runs parallel to Threadneedle Street,
and there are quite
where tailors lived
these,
and where the Bank of England
of
is.
These sort of courts and alleys, aren't there? There, you never notice them when you're rushing past. They're often quite old, sort of Victorian. There would have been, all sorts of counting houses, offices. There would have been kind of rookeries and slums across the city of London.
I think... Fewer rookeries and slums here in the city.
Maybe,
because,
yes.
Because it is a place, as it always has been, for finance and but banks
it would have
and
been,
counting houses
it would have
and money.
Been much, I would say, less like the London of today and more like going to some great, huge, you know, Chinese city or something where rich and poor
certainly
are jumbled up together in this sort of chaos of people.
I mean, although already you're starting to get the way in which it's the rich bankers, so it's Scrooge who lives actually in the centre, which, as we'll find out later.
And Bob lives further out.
Bob Cratchit lives further out. So he's already, he's having to walk, but he's having to commute.
But that said, the streets are still littered with urchins, with beggars.
Absolutely.
I mean, there are lots of references to that in the book.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Which is obviously not the case now, because we're here on a working day, admittedly in the middle of a pandemic, but the place is practically deserted in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But the backdrop is absolutely of wealth for those who have it. It's a domestically centered. It's behind the doors of grand houses, and then out on the streets, there's poverty and suffering and want.
Yeah, yeah,
absolutely.
All right. Well, shall we move on to our next location, Tom?
Right. So Bob Cratchit, he's gone home to Camden.
Yeah.
And Scrooge, we're told, goes out for a rather grim and unhappy meal. And I think that we should go next to the place where, the most likely place where he had this
meal. For a grim and unhappy meal.
For a grim and unhappy meal.
I look forward to it.
So, Dominic, we've come to Bengal Court, which is another of these kind of amazing side alleys.
They're a lovely kind of warren, isn't it? So
yeah,
it's
absolute
a little warren of kind of alleys
of Cornhill.
And
so, if you're walking down Cornhill and you didn't go down this kind of warren of streets, you have no idea they were here. But the reason we've come here is we're following Scrooge, who has left his counting house. And in Christmas Carol, we're told that he took his melancholy dinner in his usual melancholy tavern. And having read all the newspapers and beguiled the rest of the evening with his banker's book, so he knows how to party, went home to bed. Very Sam Brooke.
That's not very Sam Brooke at all. So there are a couple of candidates, aren't there? There are a couple of inns we've walked past. There were Simpsons.
Yeah.
There was an old Jamaica or something like that. Jamaica. But this one, I think, is...
The George and the Vulture.
Yes. And they have a bust, don't they, which we are standing beside.
Yes.
Of the great man.
And actually,
Dickens, not Scrooge, by the way.
I feel like a ragamuffin pressing my nose to the window and gazing, because it is a very, very Dickensian scene. There are kind of tables laid,
well, it's
crackers,
all laid for Christmas,
glasses,
for Christmas lunch.
And this bust of Dickens gazing out over it. Apparently, this is where every year, just before Christmas, members of the Dickens family congregate in a room, in a room upstairs to toast Dickens himself. So, of course, there is a kind of mood of Dickensian jollity here. But yeah. for Scrooge, this is all about gloom and misery. He's, you know, he's obviously having kind of a miserable meal, doesn't have any friends. It's Christmas Eve.
Yes.
And then he goes home. And again, we don't know, you know, Dickens doesn't tell us where his home is. But again, presumably it's off Cornhill because
it's
all
down
the
one
action.
Of these courts, isn't it?
And
he lived in chambers which had once belonged to his deceased partner. There were a gloomy suite of rooms in a lowering pile of building up a yard where it had so little business to be, though one could scarcely help fancying it must have run there when it was a young house, playing at hide and seek with other houses and forgotten the way out again.
Exactly. So we know because in due course he will order a turkey from yes. Leadenhall Market, which is just around the corner. His counting house is here. His likely place of supper is here. So I think the likeliest candidate is a place called White Lion Court, okay. which again is off Cornhill. Has an 18th century house, and the description you just read, it said, you know, it's an old house.
Right.
So we don't know. It's entirely fictional. But let's go there because that is, and look at the door on which perhaps Marley's face appears as Scrooge goes up
Excellent.
To the door on Christmas Eve.
And can we talk while we're doing that, Tom? Do you think that's reasonable? I think we should talk about Scrooge.
Okay,
because
let's do
what
that.
Strikes me about Scrooge is that he's obviously a sort of repulsive and, you know, grasping and greedy figure, but he's sad, isn't he? Even yeah. from the beginning, he's sad having his dinner on his own. And
well, there's the awful when and we're slightly jumping the gun here, but when the ghost of Christmas past comes and shows him his memories, the very sad description of him at his school.
Well, yeah,
and
of
everyone's
course.
Gone home.
Of course.
And he's alone at his desk
yeah.
with no friends.
The loneliness is a huge part of the story, I think. I think that's one reason why it appeals, because there's a bit of Scrooge. There's a bit of Scrooge in all of us. That sort of deliberately cynical, miserable, because we feel lonely or left out or whatever. Do you
yes,
not think?
Yes, Dominic. Well, I mean,
I'm thinking of you, actually, Tom. I'm thinking of you. I'm just trying
as
to be nice
say,
to you.
Well, as you say, Dominic, there's a little bit of Scrooge in all of
yeah.
us. Anyway, so we're now we've come back out from the Warren of Rose, and we're going past beneath St. Michael's Cornhill. With the
yeah.
Gothic window, it is
so this
a very
is the
high
church, right?
tower. Yep,
it's Christopher Wren Church. Unusually for a Wren church,
yep.
it has these Gothic windows. So yep. it's not a Wren church, like you know that you would traditionally
no, not,
expect.
Not a classic. And we're back on Cornhill, and we're walking.
Some nice drilling
we're
in
walking,
the background.
We're walking up Cornhill from the Bank of England towards what is the highest point in the whole city of London, but you'd barely know it. So it's one of the three hills of London.
Not really a hill, is it? I mean, it's barely an incline.
Tower Hill, Ludgate Hill, on which St. Paul stands, and this Cornhill.
With these colossal kind of financial
well,
towers
yes.
now so, overshadowing it.
So the language of money, I mean, it absolutely dominates, obviously, Christmas Carol. You know, it's all about the Bank of England, exchange,
yeah.
bills of exchange,
yeah.
ledgers, all that kind of stuff. And as we walk up to towards Leadenhall, towering over us are the heirs of
well, they are. I mean,
the
like,
heirs of
you know,
Scrooge's counting house.
There's the sort of what's that? Is that the Lloyd's Building?
Yeah, the Lloyd's Building.
The
is
Lloyd's
further
Building.
Down, but there's the
further
the
along
cheese grater. We've got the gherkin behind that.
If you ever watch those fantastic kind of recolorized, you know, sort of newsreel and things, kind of early film visions of Edwardian London or early 20th century London, the demographic mix is very different from how it is today. It's a lot older.
Yeah.
It's a lot more socially variegated than, you know, when we walk yeah. around these streets.
Yeah, but
there's only
you,
one kind of yeah. people here.
Yeah. Although, I mean, we're going to be doing an episode, aren't we, in the new year on 1922.
We are.
As the year in which modernity is born. And that's the year in which The Wasteland is published. And Eliot gives this kind of terrifying description of
the people sweeping across
yeah, the people crossing
the
London
Bridge,
yeah. the dead. I had not thought death had undone so many.
Yes.
Anyway, so we have come to one of the many candidates for where Scrooge's house
this
might
looks
have been.
Perfect, Tom.
Yeah.
This genuinely looks
yeah.
absolutely perfect.
So it's White Lion Court, and there is, you know, there's an old house. It looks rather handsome now. It's painted in a bright kind of purple. There are a couple of lions stuck outside. So very much cheerier than it might have been if this had
but
been
it could
Scrooge's
once
house.
Have looked fantastically
yes.
dreary. You could make it look fantastically
yes.
dreary, couldn't you?
Absolutely.
So what is it? Probably Georgian house. Looking, judging by
yeah,
the sort
so
of windows.
Yeah, so it's 18th century house. But you could, I guess you could imagine a door knocker on the on those doors and it kind of warping could. And
so tell
and,
us about the door knocker, Tom. Do you have
so
the...
Scrooge comes up to it, knocks on it, sees Marley's face. Marley is his partner who's died, and he humbug yes. goes upstairs and has a
well,
festive...
this is the first hint, isn't there, of the supernatural. That and our producer was saying to us as we were walking over that that's one of the elements that makes this such a great story. It's not just the lesson, it's not just the sentiment, but it's also that it's quite scary. And particularly, it's interesting because now it's often thought of as quite a children's story. So you can buy it as a Puffin children's classic, and obviously, thanks to the Muppets, it's become a kind of family, you know, a sort of family
and
festive.
It's kind of staged as pantomimes and things, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but not at the time. That it's not a children's story at all at the time, is it? I mean, Dickens is writing for adults.
Absolutely. So famously, Scrooge retires for the night, and he hears a clanking and a dragging.
Yeah.
And into his room walks the ghost of Jacob Marley. And Jacob Marley is dragging behind him ledger books and chains and all the appurtenances of his long career as a banker. And perhaps the most chilling detail of all, he has a cloth wrapped around his underneath his jaw and over his head. And at one point he removes it and his jaw drops off.
That's right, like Robespierre.
Like Robespierre.
That's what happened to Robespierre.
So all the muscles and everything that are holding the jaw have frayed away while he's been in the grave. So that's very frightening. And Marley says, I'm going to be sending you three ghosts. Basically, so, to pep you up,
yeah. So Marley
and teach you the meaning of Christmas.
He's John the Baptist here, isn't he? He's not the messenger himself, but he's the sort of...
Well, he is a messenger, isn't he? He's the angel announcing the ghosts that are going to come. But, I mean, so Dickens's attitudes to ghosts, I mean, he does, I think, see them as... I mean, he's a 19th century man. He's skeptical about them. He you know, ostensibly doesn't believe in them. But you could see from the anecdote of him... being terrified in the Pittsburgh penitentiary.
And he wrote The Signal Woman, which is one of the great ghost stories ever.
Yeah.
You know, brilliant, and actually the 70s TV adaptation with Denholm Elliott, absolutely superb. But so Dickens is, like all Victorians, fascinated by death, by memory, by the spiritual,
and I think that one of the things about, you know, living through the pandemic at the moment is it does take us back to the kind of world in which death was a constant presence in life. And that one of the reasons why Christmas is so important to Dickens is precisely that the streets are stalked by pestilence and
terror.
Yes,
that thing
about
the darkness
dread.
And the cozy, right?
Yeah,
you need the darkness makes the bright seem all the brighter.
Yeah. So Marley retires and Scrooge is left alone. Marley says, you don't believe in me, do you? And Scrooge says, I don't believe you at all. You may be an undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of an underdone potato. There's more of gravy than of grave about you,
that's
whatever
right.
you are.
It's more of gravy than of grave. That's such a great line.
But that's kind of brilliantly Dickensian, having his cake and eating it, you know, doubting that it exists, and yet it's kind of horrible and
of
terrifying
course.
At the same time. So Marley withdraws, and then these three ghosts...
Yes.
Come.
So the Ghost of Christmas Past, first of all.
Yeah.
So we're digging into Scrooge's own past here, aren't we? So it starts, I think, with that tremendous scene that you mentioned of Scrooge. He's basically at boarding school. Everybody else has gone home for the holidays. He is on his own. This sort of...
A solitary child neglected by his friends is left there still.
And that, you see, that's the thing that when I said... I know you thought it was hilarious when I said there's a bit of Scrooge and all that. It's rather like Richard Nixon. But Richard Nixon is not unlike Scrooge, actually. But that sort of thing of being the one child who's left behind. I mean, there are very few listeners who won't empathise with that. Some, you know, weren't the last to be picked up after the party or whatever. And that's very Dickens.
Yeah.
That taking somebody
back to
their...
The boy sent to the blacking factory.
Yeah, to their childhood roots. That's where it all went wrong. You know, the mean-spiritedness of your nature is rooted in sadness and solitariness and all those things.
Yeah. And then the Ghost of Christmas Past takes us through Scrooge's memories, and there is a description of an absolutely kind of classic Dickensian Christmas knees up.
Yeah.
Mr. Fezziwig. Fezziwig.
Or Fozziwig, as he is in the Muppets version. Yes.
He's
Fozzie
Bear.
Bear.
And it's a wonderful... there's a kind of wonderful illustration by John Leach, who did the early illustrations of Mr. Fezziwig dancing.
He's got a Welsh wig, Mr. Fezziwig. I don't know what a Welsh wig is.
Yes, and they strike up Sir Roger de Coverley, which was an English dance.
Right.
Named after a character in The Spectator.
In The Spectator?
I think the early 18th century Spectator rather than the Boris Johnson edited Spectator. But I've always wondered, what, you know, I felt that that's a bit that's been missing from my Christmas.
You'd like to do a bit more dancing?
I'd like to do Sir Roger de Coverley. I have no idea what it is. So if anyone out
there... I'm not going to do it with you now.
So any of the listeners out there have any idea what Sir Roger de Coverley sounds like, you know, let us know. I'd love to hear it.
Yes. Maybe they can let us know on the Discord chat if they're members of the Rest Is History Club. Yes. An ideal Christmas present, and it is not too late to go to restishistorypod.com.
Yes, if you want to come in out of the darkness and the cold into our...
That's brilliant promotional work, I thought. That was completely seamless.
Very Scrooge-like.
I brought my ledgers with me.
So, so basically Scrooge is shown the process by which this young boy who you know, he might have married, he might have had a family, but he decides not to because he chooses to marry his ledger books.
That's right, because his sweetheart abandons him. Is she called Bella?
Yeah.
She says, you care about money more than me. Yeah.
And he says, humbug.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's absolutely right. So the ghost of Christmas past goes. Scrooge wakes up. He's a bit discombobulated.
Yeah.
But still not entirely convinced. And then the Ghost of Christmas Present arrives. And the Ghost of Christmas Present is absolutely fantastic because he appears.
He's like a feast in human form.
He does.
Isn't he?
And he's a kind of giant, colossal, bearded man, but he has a great throne which consists entirely of festive food. So turkeys, geese, game, poultry, brawn, great joints of meat, sucking pigs, long wreaths of sausages, mince pies, plum puddings, barrels of oysters, red hot chestnuts, cherry-cheeked apples, juicy oranges, luscious pears, immense 12 cakes, and seething bowls of punch that made the chamber dim with their delicious steam.
That's like my Christmas dinner.
That's exactly how I imagine the Sandbrook household
exactly.
over Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely.
You... with a great horn of plenty, toasting ragamuffins,
exactly.
handing turkeys out left, right, and centre to the poor.
Throwing shillings to urchins.
Exactly. That's how I imagine. Anyway, so the Ghost of Christmas Present then shows Scrooge what's going on.
Well, they go to the market, don't they? Isn't there a first scene where the people are kind of all...
Yeah.
They're basically doing their Christmas shopping.
Yeah, and they're all happy.
Yeah.
And everyone in Dickens loves doing Christmas shopping.
Yeah, it's very, very unlike
so wholly
the reality.
Implausible and fictional.
Yeah.
They all absolutely adore it.
The sort of stressed people with juggling wrapping paper,
yeah.
desperately fighting for the last pigs in blankets in Tesco.
Yes. Yes. And then he is shown his nephew. Who we should have mentioned earlier had come
Fred.
In.
Fred has previously said, why don't you come and join us for Christmas?
And Scrooge has said, bah humbug.
Yeah, he has said, bah humbug.
So Scrooge has shown them all kind of saying what a miserable old stick Scrooge is.
Well, they play some sort of game, don't they, where they have to guess who he is.
Yes.
I'm a sort of animal.
Yes, a kind of miserable old,
yeah.
terrifying creature, monster.
And it's Scrooge. And Scrooge is gutted when he finds out that they're laughing at him behind his back.
And then they are taken to Camden. And to Bob Cratchit's house,
yes.
where all the various Cratchit children are feasting on a goose, which is a very small goose, and there's a very small Christmas pudding. But because they have the spirit of Christmas, they're happy.
There never was such a goose. Bob said he didn't believe there ever was such a goose cooked. Its tenderness and flavour, size and cheapness were the themes of universal admiration.
And is there a particular child, Dominic, who perhaps you've made play with in an advert for beer on our podcast?
See, the producer finds this absolutely hilarious because
he wrote it, didn't he?
He wrote it. Tiny Tom. I will perhaps save a glass of beer 52. I hope they pay us extra for this in episode advertising for Tiny Tom. Yeah, so...
Tiny Tim.
So Tiny Tim. Now, Tiny Tim is kind of Little Nell, isn't he, really?
Mm-hmm.
So Little Nell was the character in the old curiosity shop who had famously, I hesitate to spoil it for people, but she dies. And there had been universal kind of weeping and wailing.
So all those listeners who are just 3/4 of the way through the old curiosity shop.
How many such listeners do you think there are?
I'm sure there are lots. Absolutely ruined
And of course,
it for
people
them.
In America had famously
sobbing.
Kind of, you know, been at the quayside waiting
and
for
Oscar
the next
Wilde
installment.
Is famously
yes,
rude
it
about
take
it.
A heart of stone not
to laugh.
Laugh.
Yeah.
But Tiny Tim is kind of Little Nell. He's a sentimental... Yeah.
He's got little crutches.
Martyr figure with his crutches carried on Bob Cratchit's back. Bob is incredibly long-suffering and will, you know, run with Tiny Tim. And Tiny Tim can do no wrong.
Scrooge.
He does. So Mr. Scrooge, who made it possible, and his wife, who's Miss Piggy, in the Muppet version, says, Scrooge, if he was here, I would give him that box's ears or whatever.
Yeah.
And yeah, but Bob is such a sort of a fine fellow that he won't hear a word against Scrooge. Even though Scrooge treats him like dirt.
And Tiny Tim is obviously a chip off the old block because he has his famous toast, God bless us all, everyone.
God bless us, everyone, yes. It's very moving, Tom. I think it's very moving.
Yeah, it is. Well, that's what I found about Dickens is that when I was young and I read him, I was, you know, youthful and cynical and contemptuous of his sentimentality. Whereas now, in middle age, I just sob.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I've become far more attuned to it.
I think it's almost too tempting to sort of poke fun at Dickens.
Last Christmas, in the depths of the lockdown, I read quite a lot of Dickens. And I read A Tale of Two Cities, which I hadn't read since school.
Right.
When I really hadn't enjoyed it.
Oh, that's terribly moving at the end.
It's so good. And I was literally in tears at the end. Yeah.
I read the children's version of that to my son. And it was
a boyish tear?
It was a bit like when, no, he was completely indifferent, but it was a bit like when I read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. There were bits where I kind of...
choked up.
I was like, what's wrong with you? Why can't you carry on reading?
No. Anyway, back to Scrooge. So he's very moved by this.
Yeah.
Very worried about Tiny Tim. You know, is Tiny Tim going to be all right?
Yes.
And then the Ghost of Christmas Present vanishes, and we get the appearance of the most terrifying ghost of all, who is the ghost of Christmas to come.
So he's
Christmas
sort
future.
Of a J.K. Rowling style dementor, isn't he?
Or a Nazgul.
Or a Nazgul, yeah.
He's the Grim Reaper, isn't he?
He's a figure of utter dread.
So he's black cloaked, you can't see his face, he never talks. He only shows. But I think that we should talk about the third ghost.
Yes.
Not here.
Oh.
But... in a graveyard, which is where the ghost ends up taking
Scrooge. Not least because
there's
a lot of banging and drilling in the background, which the listeners may
well
have heard.
So let's head to our next destination on our Christmas Carol pilgrimage.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Tom, where are we now?
Okay, we have come to St. Peter upon Cornhill, which, as the name suggests, we're still in Cornhill. And this church, actually, I mean, quite aside from Dickens, is a very interesting church. You could walk along Cornhill and barely notice it.
Well, it's because St. Ian's in one of this warren of this maze of courts.
But if you come off Cornhill,
you know, you see the graveyard, and you see the back of the church. And this reputedly is the oldest church in Britain. Amazingly, Britain. Supposedly founded by that well-known historical figure, King Lucius,
right,
in the 2nd century AD.
Yeah, I don't remember him in there.
he's mentioned by Bede as being, you know, a very early Christian who founded this church. Okay. So that probably...
Did the Romans know of him?
Unlikely, right. Unlikely. But it's mentioned by John Stowe, who's the great the great Tudor writer about London at the end of the 16th century, and he cites a tablet claiming that King Lucius had founded this church. It was obviously destroyed in the Great Fire, rebuilt by Wren. The weather vane has a key in the shape of St. Peter's key, letting people into heaven. But, I mean, that's all by the by. The reason why I've brought you here is that it is probably in this graveyard that the final climactic scene in Scrooge's experience with the three ghosts occurs.
So we're the Ghost of Christmas Past.
The Ghost of Christmas Future.
Oh, sorry, yes, Ghost of Christmas Future.
And the ghost shows what is likely to come, and he shows Scrooge a kind of rag and bone man in a squalid area of London, parceling up the goods of an obviously deceased man. Nobody cares for them, nobody wants them, they're just being dispelled. Then he takes Scrooge to the city, and various bankers and financial luminaries that Scrooge knows are walking a lot through the streets talking about someone who's died in a tone of absolute kind of
they only want to go if there's going to be a free lunch, don't
exactly.
they?
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Nobody cares. And all the time Scrooge is saying, who is this person? I mean, he's either being
What a mystery.
He doesn't want to face up to the possibility of who it might be.
But then they go to Camden, don't they?
They go to Camden.
Yeah.
And they go to the Cratchits' house.
Oh, it's a terrible scene.
Is Tiny Tim still there?
No. Tiny Tim is dead. Bob has just visited the grave, hasn't he? And he says it's very green and you'd like it. And they all talk about how they'll remember Tiny Tim and what a lovely fellow he was. And they'll behave in a more Christian way now.
And the crutches are by the fire.
Oh, it's very moving.
It's very, very
moving. Well, you know, if you're 17, you laugh at this. Or if you're Oscar Wilde.
But if you're a bit older.
Yeah.
And with a child of your own.
You find it moving.
Yes, absolutely.
And then? Well, then they reach an iron gate. And I shall read from the book. It says, he paused to look around before entering a churchyard. Here then the wretched man whose name he had now to learn lay underneath the ground. It was a worthy place, walled in by houses, as it is now, walled in by houses, overrun by grass and weeds, which it isn't, but overrun by grass and weeds, the growth of vegetation's death, not life, choked up with too much burying, fat with repleted appetite, a worthy place.
The spirit leads Scrooge into this graveyard, and he points...
And Tom,
towards
tell
a
us,
grave.
Tell us what's written on the grave.
Well, following the finger, he read upon the stone of the neglected grave his own name. And Dickens puts it in capital letters, Ebenezer Scrooge.
Do you know where Ebenezer Scrooge, the name, came from?
No.
Apparently, Dickens had visited a grave in Edinburgh, I think, by a man called Ebenezer Scroggy.
Oh,
who it turned out was a very jovial man, a great philanderer, a man with an eye for the ladies and a kind of laugh a minute party goer.
But I'm glad you didn't call him Scroogie.
No, yes.
That wouldn't work at all.
Scroogie wouldn't work. Scroogie.
Anyway, so Scrooge wakes up from this, finds that, you know, it's all been a dream and that it's all happened over the course of Christmas morning.
Yes.
And he calls out to a passing boy, you know, what morn is it? And the boy says, it's Christmas morning. And Scrooge tells him to go and buy a turkey. And the boy rushes off to Leadenhall Market, which is just round the corner where we're going to head now.
A delightful boy. Excellent boy.
The first Christmas I spent in London, I came to Leadenhall Market and I bought a goose.
A goose, a turkey.
No, I bought a goose because I thought it was more Dickensian.
Well, it is more Dickensian.
It's more like
it?
Bob Cratchit.
I was a bit disappointed to have a turkey at the end rather than a goose.
And I carried it the whole way back to our little... Bob Cratchit type flat, and it was a brilliantly Dickensian experience.
Now, so Dickensian Christmases, Tom, there's light and shade in them.
Yeah. So,
and let's bring in a bit of the shade because you have had an experience, haven't you, with a turkey?
Yes.
Which always, I'm sorry to say, always slightly amuses me. Did you not once buy a turkey and have it stolen out of the back of your car?
Yes, I did.
At Christmas? Was that on Christmas Eve?
Yeah, it was on Christmas Eve, because I didn't have room. We had a very small fridge, and this was a kind of Scrooge-type turkey of an enormous size. And we wanted to keep it cold, so we kept it in the boot of the car, and some wanker.
Are you allowed to say that in a Christmas podcast?
I think so. Some wanker broke into the car and nicked it. So we just shocking. Had all the trimmings. It was very nice. It was the best Christmas ever.
Oh, yeah. That's a heartwarming
God bless us,
story.
Everyone.
Tiny Tom. Yeah. Anyway, Tom, we're in a splendid location now. So tell us where we are.
So we are now in Leadenhall Market, and there's been a market here from the 14th century. It's actually on the site of the Roman Basilica. And there's the only chunk of the Roman Basilica is to be found in the barber shop that is over there. It's in the basement. And it's a legal requirement, I think, of the planning that if you want to go and see this chunk of the basilica...
You have to have your haircut.
No, they have to let you in.
Oh, really?
They have to let you in. So you go down and see it. But this particular incarnation was built in 1881, and it's very, very Victorian. I mean, it's... So this isn't the one that Scrooge would have named, but it still gives a very Victorian,
festive
vibe.
It's a bit more late
vibe.
Victorian, isn't it?
There are wreaths everywhere. There's kind of Christmas trees. It's all very, very, very festive.
Yeah. Cheeses, and this, vintage port.
And so this is where Dickens buys his... sorry, Dickens. That's a significant slip. Yes. Scrooge buys this enormous turkey.
Yeah.
He takes it to Bob Cratchit.
So yes, this is interesting.
It gets sent, doesn't it? It gets sent.
Scrooge, everybody thinks that Scrooge pitches up at the Cratchit's house in Camden Town, but he doesn't. He goes to Fred's house.
Yeah. He
and
does.
Astonishes everybody by pitching up at Fred's.
Yeah.
So Michael Caine at the end of the Muppets, he goes to both. He does both.
Yeah.
But that's not right.
Yeah.
He should not go to visit Miss Piggy
and
Kermit.
The twist is the next morning when Bob Cratchit comes in late. Because he's had such a great time, what with all his punch and everything.
Yeah.
And Scrooge pretends to be the miserable old skinflint that he'd always been.
What a joker.
And then he says, Bob Cratchit, I'm going to give you a raise.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
And it's nonstop hilarity. And Scrooge then basically becomes a second father to Tiny
That's
Tim,
right.
who doesn't die. And they all, you know, all
now,
his festive
and well.
Here's
an interesting thing. The bit about Tiny Tim not dying. Was only added at a very late stage in the printing presses. So originally, they didn't say that explicitly. Because it's quite a sentimental touch. Tiny Tim, who did not, in capitals, die.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's just a bit of fan service, I think, as they would call it now, isn't it?
Yeah. And Scrooge, he became as good a friend, as good a master, and as good a man as the good old city knew, or any other good old city, town, or borough in the good old world.
Yes, now let's talk a bit about the meaning of A Christmas Carol, because Tony, our producer, who is this sort of glowering shadow throughout our recording, putting on, taking off his flat cap and looking disapproving at various points.
Yes, pointing out that it's made by a hat maker by appointment to the Duke of Edinburgh, while simultaneously grumbling about trade unions.
Yes,
so very,
exactly.
Very,
exactly.
Very split.
Very much.
In a kind of Dickensian way, isn't
it? Yeah, it's very much the modern Labour Party, some might say. Anyway, he has pointed out, quite rightly, then in some ways, A Christmas Carol is a very conservative book, because basically the argument of A Christmas Carol is the context, there are these tremendous inequalities, poor and rich living cheek by jowl, but sort of not meeting. But the answer to this is individual philanthropy. Is Scrooge
buy everyone a turkey. And there were people who literally did that. So there was, I think there was someone in a factory owner in Boston who read it and was, he gave everyone the day off and bought them all turkeys.
That's right, yes.
And I think somebody... There was that comment in the Times or something to the effect of, you know, ever since it's been published, people are just rushing around buying turkeys for people. that is essentially Dickens' solution to want
well,
to poverty.
Individual self-improvement and philanthropy and so on, which now people would perceive as in some ways quite a Thatcherite message, I would say.
Well, so Lenin, a few years after the Russian Revolution, went to a staging of one of Dickens' Christmas stories. And was so appalled by its bourgeois morality that he walked out midway through.
Lenin walked out of a production of Dickens.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a play in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it? Yeah, kind of Orlando Annucci doing something with that.
Yes. But I suppose that's part of the fascination with Dickens. That Dickens is simultaneously appalled by the kind of costs of, you know, Victorian progress and so on. And yet he's a moralist, isn't he? He's a as many moralists are, he tends to be quite conservative because he brings everything back to the virtue or vice of the individual rather than of society at large.
He feels horror at the institutionalization of the kind of inequalities in Victorian Britain. So Scrooge is notorious, you know, are there not workhouses?
Yes.
Are there not prisons?
Yeah.
You know, why don't people die to lower the surplus population?
Well, so anti-Malthus, isn't it?
Anti-Malthus, political economists. Again, it's the ledger book. It's the idea of reducing people to statistics, to figures in an accountancy book. That fills him with horror. And the counterpoint to that is kind of personal joy, I guess, and personal benignity. The buying of turkeys for people.
Well, that's arguably why one reason why A Christmas Carol is so successful and so popular. I mean, it was written for a very middle-class audience, for a literate middle-class audience. And that's probably the audience that it still reaches, because it's not a politically radical book in a troubling way. It's a book that says, you know, give a little bit more to charity at Christmas. And I think that's why affluent, respectable, well-off people love it. Because it makes you feel, it doesn't make Scrooge feel bad about being rich.
But I think it's also, I mean, as we said at the beginning, although it does have this kind of quite strong political seedbed, it also has a kind of, it has the quality of fairy tale, of folk tale, almost of myth or of legend. And that makes, I mean, I'm sure that's one of the reasons why it must rank as the most adapted story, certainly in English, is that you can do almost anything with it. So you can, you know, obviously, when I said that we were doing this show, lots of people wrote and said, you must mention the Muppets as the best. And we have given, I think, lots of airtime to the Muppets. But also, you know, you had Scrooge McDuck, the Disney version of it.
Scrooge with Bill Murray.
Yes. So it's come in many, many shapes and forms. And I think that reflects the fact that it is infinitely malleable.
Yeah.
And infinitely parodable, infinitely adaptable.
And as we said in our Christmas podcast that we did at this time last year, Christmas is in many ways Dickens's and the Victorians' creation, isn't it?
Yeah.
The turkey, the goose, the trimmings, the carols, the cards, the tree. These things date from Dickens's lifetime. So we're still kind of, you know, we are almost self-consciously reenacting a Victorian Christmas every time we celebrate Christmas.
And I think, Dominic, that is the perfect note on which to end.
You look like you're gearing up for a reading, Tom, are you?
No, I'm going to say Happy Christmas to everyone. Festive best wishes. And God bless us.
God bless us.
Everyone.
Everyone. From me and from Tiny Tom, Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.